Everyone for coming this evening. I know the flyer for the shiur. I don't want to say it's a little bit sad, but I think the shiur hopefully will end up a little more optimistic than where it starts. That's the goal. That's the hope. That's really the goal and hope of every Tisha B'Av, to end up a little more optimistically than where we started. Let's begin with the basics, the background, and make our way through what I hope will be an inspiring way to just gain a little perspective of what we are about to enter in the coming days and leading up through Tisha B'Av. So the Gemara tells us, as far as the background is concerned, this is in source number one. It's a Gemara in Tainus. It's a Mishnah, actually. That final parak in the Masechta talks about the significance and the historical background of the fast days that we're familiar with this time of year. It talks about Shavuos HaBetamos. There were five tragic events that took place on Shavuos HaBetamos. We've discussed those before. Now when it comes to Tisha B'Av, the Mishnah lists as follows. B'Tisha B'Av nigzar al v'aseinu shalikantzu la'aretz. The very first event that we are marking, as far as, again, the history, the tragic history, is the fact that it was decided that the Jewish people would not enter the land of Israel. That first generation that left Mitzrayim was not allowed to enter Eretz Israel. B'charav habayis b'rishono u'bashniya. Number two, the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. V'nilkada Beitar, the capture of the city of Beitar, which was a very significant defeat. It actually took place after the Beis HaMikdash was already destroyed, but it was one of the final glimmers of hope that Jews would still maintain autonomy, would still maintain control of some part of Eretz Yisrael, and that was ultimately destroyed as well. And there was tremendous loss of life, and it was so cruel that the Romans didn't even let the Jews bury the casualties, the dead, from that war. For a very long time, the fourth bracha of our benching, the bracha of Al Yechasreinu, is actually, the Gemara tells us, was instituted when they finally got permission to bury the bodies from the war. None of them had decomposed. So miraculously, Hashem preserved them until it was time for their burial to occur, and we actually added on to benching in order to mark that miracle. So that was the next item on the list, and the final item on the list is V'nechush HaHir. The city, Yerushalayim, was plowed over. And that also was a point which it wasn't the primary tragedy, but it extinguished the final glimmers of hope. You know, once the city is flattened, once it's razed, R-A-Z-E-D, so any chance they thought of maybe coming back was made unrealistic. And then finally, Mishenechnas Av Mematin Besimcha, well-known phrase which has implications when it comes to the month of Av. Just like in Adar, we increase our happiness, and we see it as a month where it's very optimistic. If a person has a court case, supposed to schedule it for Adar. If you have a court case, you're supposed to avoid setting it during the month of Av. As a side note, there's a discussion, what about after Tisha B'Av? What about the 18th of Av? Just picking a day, a couple weeks from now. Is the month over once Tisha B'Av comes, or no? Is there still this ominous period that extends until Elul begins? Okay, but we're not going to get into that right now. This is how the Mishnah introduces to us. Sorry? Okay, but that still might not be, Tu B'Av has its own significance, but it might still be, we're not out of the woods yet until the end of the month. That's a debate. Okay, so that's the background in the Mishnah. That's the history. When we look in the Pesukim, we find, goes back to Parsha Shlach, when the Meraglim came back with their report about Eretz Yisrael. Vatisa, number two, Vatisa kol ha'ida v'ayinu es kolam v'yivku ha'am b'layla ha'hu. The people, when they heard this report, the response was their voices were heard, and they cried that night. They cried that night. Even before we hear what their words were, we hear that they were crying. So keep that in the back of your head, because that's very significant, right? That's the stamp on the day, the cries, the tears of the Jewish people. They say to Aaron and to Moshe, they complained, if only we had died in Egypt, that would have been better, right? Rather than us having to suffer this fate in the desert. It would have been better if we were in Egypt, because this way, we're just going to be killed. We're going to try to enter Israel, they're going to massacre us, and it's terrible. It's going to leave our wives and our children for the taking, to be captives, and what do we need this for? And famously, as happens a few times over the course of the 40 years during the Jewish people's period in the Midbar, they say we'd rather go back to where we started. Okay, so that's the picture we have in Bamidbar. The focus, again, we're going to keep this in the back of our heads, is that it began with a cry. The bechia, the cry, the tears, that's what introduces our reaction, our response. So significant are those cries. In source number 3, the Medrash tells us, the earlier version had a different Medrash. I just changed this one because I think it's a little more explicit. Amar Lam HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm reading from Bamidbar Rabbah, source number 3. Amar Lam HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Atem bechisam bechia shalchinam lefanai. You cried a bechia shalchinam, a worthless, empty, meaningless, senseless cry before me. Ani ekbalachem bechila doros. So in exchange, I'm going to be koveya ekba. I'm going to designate this day, right? It's going to be a bechila doros forever. You're going to be crying when it comes to Tisha B'Av. That night was Tisha B'Av. You're crying for no reason. I'm going to give you a reason to cry forever and ever. I mean, osa shah nigzra al beis hamigdash. From that point on, Hashem already determined that Tisha B'Av would be the date on which the Batei Mikdash would be destroyed, that would result in the gullus that would send the Jewish people to be dispersed amongst the nations. Okay? So, if you think about it, right, the significance of the Beis HaMikdash being destroyed on Tisha B'Av, it's really the reverse, right? That this is an outgrowth. Beis HaMikdash being destroyed on Tisha B'Av is an outgrowth of a sin that took place a long time, 1,000 years before that even happened, namely the cries on the night of Tisha B'Av in response to the report of Eretz Yisrael that the Meraglim, that the spies brought back, that was negative. So you see that the Beis HaMikdash is almost secondary. Right? The Beis HaMikdash was something that happened later, but essentially what Tisha B'Av is really about is not the Beis HaMikdash, but what predated, what was the cause of the Batei Mikdash being destroyed, and that is the cry, the response, which in its own right seems to be totally disconnected from the Churban, from the destruction of the Batei Mikdash, which only came later. Let's move on to number 4. Number 4 is from the parsha we read just yesterday. Okay, now when you think about it, it's hard sometimes when we read about, you know, the Parshas Devarim, which is a reconstitution, you know, in Moshe's words of what happened earlier parts of the Chumash. So you may not always remember the details from a few weeks or a few months back. But here, we're going to line up, we just read Parshas Shlach in source number 2. I'm going to hold it up against number 4, which is what we read yesterday. So obviously the two stories, the two versions complement each other. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to add some details that were not relevant for whatever reason the first time around, but add new light once we see them now. Read slowly. We're going to have the whole background. I gave it away. The darkened portion of the paragraph is most important. But the pasuk says as follows, starting from the beginning of source number 4. Vatikravun elai kulchem, vatomru nishlacha anashim lefaneinu. This is the very beginning of Parsha Shlach. You came to me. Kulchem, you all came to me. This was a mass attempt to influence Moshe Rabbeinu to send anashim, to send men to be the spies, lefaneinu, ahead of us, v'yachbur lanu ha'aretz, to search out whatever they can find out about Israel, v'yashivu osanu davar, and return to us with a report, es haderech asher nalava, the direction we should take, how we should enter the land, esa arim asher navo alam, and the cities that we're going to try to conquer, v'yita v'inei ha'davar, I thought the idea was a pretty good idea, v'ekach mekem shneim asar anashim, and I selected from amongst you 12 men, isha echad l'shevet, one man per tribe. By Yifnu, by Yalu Ahara, they went and they ascended. By Voa Nachal Eshkol, by Yiraglu Osa, they came to a certain part that became known as Nachal Eshkol, the valley of, or the river of the Eshkol, the cluster of grapes that they brought back. Okay, by Yiraglu Osa, and they scoped out whatever it is there was to see. By Chuvi Adam Priya Arth, they brought back in their hands fruit of the land. By Yeridu Aylino, they brought it back down to us. By Shibu Osanu Davar, and they gave us the report. By Yom Tova Arts, Hashem Hashem Elokeinu Noseimanu. We're about to enter a fabulous place. Hashem gave us a beautiful land. V'lo avisam la'alos, v'tamuros pi Hashem Elokeinu. Nevertheless, you were not interested in going. Okay, obviously he's leaving out some of the details about the negative spin that the Meraglim gave, but that's not relevant for us right now. Here's key. V'tiragnu ba'alechem. When you went back to your tents after hearing that report and you discussed it amongst yourself and you complained amongst yourselves, the response was, you know what, around the dinner table that night, what was everyone saying to each other? Besinas Hashem Osanu, God hates us. God hates us, and that's why he took us out of Egypt. He hates us, that's why he took us out of Egypt, and that's why he's going to bring us into the land of Israel. Lases osanu biyado amori lashmidenu. In order to put us, to give us into the hands of the Amorim, the native nations that live in the land, we're just going to wipe us out. I was in shul yesterday just like we were. I don't know, how come no one just like got out of their seat and started yelling in the middle of the lane? Like, what in the world? This sin, God hates you. How could the Jewish people possibly claim that God hates us? Just to put things in perspective, this was shortly after the Jews left Har Sinai. Okay, Har Sinai was pretty much where they spent the first year following Egypt. So they left Mitzrayim, 10 plagues, Yam Suf, miraculous destruction of the Egyptians, everything's washed onto the shore. They're walking away with unimaginable riches that were, you know, part of the Egyptian entourage. They settle in, they get the Torah, Hashem comes down. And now the first move that they make, a few steps away from Har Sinai, after God came down and spoke to them, He must hate us. And He's just trying to kill us. Like, I understand, you know, I can give you 10 other responses that I would have put in the mouths of the Jewish people in Parsha Shlach. Okay, and some of them are actually there, right? They say, it's going to be too difficult for us. Okay, so you don't believe, you know, by human means that you can do this? Okay, you know, there's a Rashi in this week's Parsha in Devarim that says, had they not sent the Meraglim, they would have entered the land and won all the wars without a single weapon. Wow, okay? So I understand, maybe not everybody can imagine a miraculous victory like that. Okay, someone's got to, especially because it happens to be, they did leave Egypt with weapons, right? The Pasuk says at the beginning of Bishalach, it says that the Jewish people left the Chamushim Alu B'nai Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim. In modern Hebrew, Chamush means armed, right? So it means they were armed, they left Mitzrayim, and that's why they had, you know, swords and whatever else, you know, implements that they needed to fight against Amalek and other nations that they encountered while they were in the Midbar. So they had weapons, okay? So you're going to tell me that maybe they weren't ready to swallow a conquest of an entire country and seven nations without a single shot being fired? Okay, but your response is that God hates us? What is going on? What is going on? That is the most puzzling piece of the entire story. And that's what's introduced to us yesterday in the parsha that we read closest to Tisha B'Av. Okay, we're not going to read the rest of the paragraph inside, but to summarize, everything else is, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu saying that, God took your response and was infuriated and decided that that's it, you're not going into Egypt. And so you're not going into Israel. The only people who are going to make it are the two spies who came back with a positive report, Kalev and Yoshua. They're the ones who are going to be able to enter Israel, and everyone else is going to be left behind. What does that mean? How could they possibly see all the loving care and miracles and turn that upside down and say Hashem hates us? That's really our main question. Let's try to take some steps towards answering. Turn to page number 2. Those of you at home, we're on source number 5. At the top of the second page, this is a Gemara in Yuma. The Gemara in Yuma asks the following question, again, taking a perspective on the time the Jews spent in Egypt. Shalom Talmidav es Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. The students asked the great Rashbi, the great Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, et neimat lo yard lahem liYisrael mon pam achas b'shana. Why didn't God just work it out that for 40 years, the Jews ate morning, afternoon, and evening, they had mon. That's all they had. That's all they needed. That was 3 square meals a day. Okay? Why couldn't Hashem just give it to them in one shot? At the beginning of the year, you know, if Hashem could make a miracle that it could taste whatever they wanted to taste like, He could also make a miracle that, like we spoke about yesterday in the shiur, take a little bit, a little morsel, you know, and that'll keep you going and give you the nutrients you need to be healthy. Why do we have to have a process? And Torah goes at length to discuss this. Yom, every single day, they had to schlep out. You know, if the whole point of their you know, miraculous lifestyle in the Midbar was to make things easy, they didn't have to work for their living, why do they have to schlep out every single day? Why couldn't they just get what they wanted for the week, for the month, for the year, and just kick back and enjoy? So we're going to start with the first. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai actually gave 3 answers. I want to start with the most Jewish answers, okay? You skip to the end of the paragraph in the underlined bolded area. Davar Acha, the second answer he gave them was, Shayu Ochlan Osok Shulchan. He wanted to give them a nice, warm, fresh meal. If you give it to them at the beginning of the week or the month or whatever, you know, it wouldn't be hot. No one wants, you know, man out of the freezer. Okay, so he, right off the stove, nice and hot and fresh. Okay, That's a very Jewish answer. Dover acher, mebnei masoi haderach. He didn't want them to have to schlep from one place to another the mun, you know, that just make it easier for them. It comes down from the sky. Some say they made a bracha on it. Hamotzi lechem min hashamayim. Okay? And this way they didn't have to take it wherever they went. Rabbi Shimon Yochai gave a different answer as well. Okay? A much deeper answer. That's the better part of the paragraph. Go back to the beginning. The second line. Amar lahem. Em sholachem mashal. I'll give you the following parable. You probably have heard something similar to this before. Em sholachem mashal. This is a way to think about it. Lama adav erdomo. What is this comparable to? Lamel basav adam shgeishol ben echad. There's a king. Of course there's a king. Okay? And there's a son. Okay? The son is, I don't know, he's an ambassador, or he's a statesman, and he has responsibilities outside of the palace, and he deals with the people, and pasuk l'mazonos of pamachz b'shana. So he made an arrangement with him. You know, you have a lot of things to do. I'm going to give you a check at the beginning of the year. You put that money in the account, you know, and expense it. For the rest of the year, just, you know, swipe your card, and it'll draw from the expense account. Okay. The son had no reason to go back to his father other than once a year to get another check to stick into the account, right? Because everything else was automatic. It was already in the account. Father missed him. Father felt that, you know, the disconnect wasn't healthy to have a relationship where I saw him once a year. So instead, he said, you know what, we're gonna rearrange this. Instead, come to me every morning before you go out to the office, and I'll give you your daily allowance, and then you'll be good to go. So then he saw him every single day. They had breakfast together, and they could schmooze, and they had a relationship. So too, the Jewish people, each one had, okay, 4 or 5 kids. All right, I don't know where that number comes from. It's interesting. 4 or 5 kids. Each person said, look, I got a mishpach, I got a family to feed, I got mouths to feed. Maybe the month's not going to fall tomorrow. Maybe I'm not going to have enough to support them. So when they got up and davened shachris before they went out to search for mun, they davened for real. They davened the way we should all daven before we go to work. Okay? They davened not really knowing if they could bring home the, not the bacon, but it's a shaila actually, if you could have in mind whether mun could taste like something, what if I want a cheeseburger, right? God, I want a cheeseburger today, okay? That's a point of debate, okay? Parv cheeseburger, okay? Parv cheeseburger. So the mun was something they really had to daven for because they couldn't count on it being there the next day. But it kept bringing them back to Hashem. The crux of what Rav Shem Ben Yochai is trying to say is the system was designed in such a way that would maintain the connection, that we never lost track of our need to remain connected to Hashem, which sheds light on a very important Gemara number 6 from Rav Yossi. God is different than a human being. Why? If a human being would get in a fight or have some bone to pick with another person, if he could somehow undercut him, you know, if he could slash his tires or get at his business in a, you know, and send his customers elsewhere, get at his parnas in some way, then he's going to do it. God is not like that. Who was the first person who started up with Hashem? It was the snake. Okay? How did Hashem respond to the snake? Kilo as hanachash. He cursed the snake, but how did he curse him? He said, you're going to eat from the dust. Olo lagag mizanos of imo. Yored lamata mizanos of imo. That wasn't a curse. That was the greatest bracha. Wherever the snake went, he could be up here, he could be down there. Wherever he went, there's always something to eat. He doesn't have to work because what he eats, you know, he eats mice. I don't know. I always grew up thinking that, you know, you feed the in lab. We fed a mouse to a snake. Okay, but the pasuk says they eat dirt. They eat dust. Wherever the snake goes, he has something to eat. So is that really a claw? Is that really a curse? The answer is yes. Hashem said, I don't want to see you anymore. I don't want to see you anymore. Every other being in this world, certainly the human beings, their system is set up in a way where you have to constantly rely on the fact that Hashem is going to send you what you need. The snake has been banished, so to speak, from Hashem's presence. Okay, come back once a year. Come back, you know, have a nice life. I'm not interested in having a connection with you anymore. That is the flip side. That's the antithesis of the system that Hashem created in the Midbar for the Jewish people to always keep coming back to Hashem. Look at source number 7. Source number 7 is a puzzling Gemara unless you have this background. Gemara says in Pesachim, Kuf Yud Ches Amar Aleph, Amar Rebbe Shimon Levi, B'shosh Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Adam, Kotz V'Dardar Tatzmiach Lach. In that same episode, Hashem says to Adam HaRishon, what's going to grow from the ground? The thorns and thistles, and that's going to be what you're going to take from. Kotz V'Dardar Tatzmiach Lach. Thorns and thistles are going to grow for you. Zolgu Einav Demos. Please listen to this. Adam HaRishon began to cry. Zolgu Einav Demos means his eyes began to shed tears. What did he say? Amar Lefano, he said, Ribbono Shalom Hashem, Ani v'chamori ne'achal bavus echad. I'm going to eat with my donkey. You're telling me I'm going to eat, you know, the junk. I'm going to eat the thorns, and that's going to be my lunch. I'm going to eat together with from the same trough as my animal. And once Hashem said, by the sweat of thy brow, you shall eat bread, niskara daito. Then Adam HaRishon was happy. Understand? Hashem said, no, don't worry. You're going to have to work like crazy to cultivate and grow things. And don't worry. It's not like you and the donkey. Why was that an assurance? Why did that put Adam HaRishon at ease? Right? Neither menu sounds very enticing. I don't want to eat with the donkey. I don't want to have to work for a living. We misunderstood. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, the Rebbe of Yerushalayim, the early part of the 20th century, said, no, what he was crying about was he felt, if you're going to give me my sustenance just growing naturally without any effort, that is putting me in the same doghouse or snake house, right, where you just banish the snake. You said, I don't want to see you anymore. I'm just going to give you what you need to survive and don't come back to me. As soon as you told me, no, I'm going to have to work for it. I have to put in effort. I'm going to depend on your good graces, Hashem. Then Adam said, I know I have to be punished, but at least you didn't say sayonara to me. At least you didn't say, I don't want to maintain that connection with you. This is going to start shedding light on where we're coming from when we want to answer this question. In source number 6, Rashi tells us, explaining that puzzling line we saw earlier, Besinas Hashem Osanu. God hates us, Hotzionu Me'eretz Mitzrayim, and that's why he took us out of Egypt. What does that mean? Hotza'aso l'sina haisa. He expressed his hatred by taking us out. Mashal Melech Basar V'Dam. Another parable of a king. Shehayu lo shnei banim, he had two sons. V'yesh lo shnei sados. Achas shel sakya v'achas shel bal. One field, one tract of land was irrigated. It was near the river, and there were irrigation ditches that brought the water from the river to irrigate the land. That was number one. And there's another son that received in his inheritance a land that did not have that same luxury, and he had to draw the water from the well every single day, from, you know, bucket by bucket, and schlep to water the field. L'mishu oheb nosin shel shakya, l'mishu sonei nosin lo shabal. So everyone said the one that he likes, the son that he likes better, he's the one who got the one with the sprinkler system already installed, and the one who has to schlep every day from the well with the water, he's the guy who the king is not so impressed with. Eretz Mitzrayim shel shakyohi. The land of Egypt is a land that it's irrigated automatically. At certain points during the year, the Nile overflows and the water goes where it needs to go. Unlike Eretz Canaan shel bal. Votzianu mimitzrayim l'aseis lanu es Eretz Canaan. Hashem took us out and brought us to Israel, a place where we're constantly praying and hoping and depending on the rain, because there is no system of irrigation from the Nile Delta that the Egyptians had. So you know why Hashem hates us? Because he gave us the part of the world where we really, really have to work hard in order to sustain ourselves. We were in a place where, like magic, the Nile gave us what we needed. In source number 9, this is what Moshe Rabbeinu tells them later, before he dies, in Parshas Ekev, Ki ha'aretz asher atah basham l'rishta, lo ke'aretz Mitzrayim hi. The land you're about to come to is not like Egypt. Asher yitzasu misham, that you left. Asher tizra ezaracha v'shkisa v'raglecha kagan hayarak. It's easy. It's so easy to cultivate there. You plant, and the water is just going to come at your feet and produce. The arta shartem ovrim shama, but the land that you're passing towards, l'rishta, to inherit, eretz harim ubekos, there's all kinds of topography there. L'matar shemayim tishtamayim, and from the rain, that's what you depend upon. So it wasn't luxurious. It wasn't easy. It was more work. So their reaction was, Hashem hates us. This is the key.
they perceived that additional labor in a way that made them feel distance from Hashem. What's the reality? The reality is just the opposite. The fact that they can't just sit back and wait for the Nile to overflow, the fact that they need to pray and daven and hope that the rain is going to come, was Hashem saying, I'm not hating you. On the contrary, because I love you, I put you in a situation that demands that you maintain your connection to me constantly. In the same way that the mon was delivered to them, in the same way that Adam HaRishon was told you're going to have to work for it, and in the opposite of the snake. Egypt, the Egyptians got the snake type of living. The last pasuk on page number 9, Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Usot Tamid. The beauty of Israel is it's the land that God is always looking at. It's not on autopilot. Egypt is on autopilot. Eretz Yisrael is not on autopilot. Hashem's always looking there. Eini Hashem Elokecha Ba Meirishis Hashem Ad Achrishon. From the beginning of the year to the end of the year, Hashem is taking a look to see what do you need, and are you doing what you need to get it? And that means Hashem magnetically draws himself to where you are, signifying how you are supposed to draw yourself to him. When you put this all together, what Rashi is essentially telling us is the Jews thought that they were being hated by Hashem. Not because the miracles would cease, not because they didn't appreciate what had already been done, but they saw where things were headed, and what they interpreted as a sign of Hashem creating distance was in reality a sign of Hashem bringing them as close as he possibly could. Bringing them to Israel was the way that they would be constantly plugged into Hashem. Again, like I said before, they would daven every day in the midbar, hoping that the mon would be there in the same way that we're all supposed to daven before we go out and try to earn a living on a daily basis. There's an important principle that unlocks this for us. The Maharal, I believe, writes like this, Rabbi Tzadok, HaKohen, the Vilna Gaon, they all say when you really want to get to the core, the heart of a concept in the Torah, the way to do it is look, examine at the very first time that it appears. We did this on Shabbos a little bit. We looked at the original machlokas, the very first controversy between two sides that appears in history. When is the first time that we find crying in history, in the Torah? I have to admit, this is a tricky one. Yesterday, I asked the Sephardi Minyan, where's the first time there's a machlokas? They said, Kain and Hevel. That's a good answer. Okay? We were working from a medrash. It's not explicit on the psukim that the sun and the moon had a little bit a difference of opinion. This one's really hard. Where's the first time that we find crying? Where's the first time we have crying? So look at the second page, page number 10. The explanation is in the Zohar. Okay? What's that?
Esav was crying.
Esav cried when he didn't get the bracha. Okay? What's that?
Hagar
cries. Okay, this is way beyond that. Way before that. Hagar cries. Okay? Before that.
Yeah.
Before that. Yaakov, okay, that's moving a little in the other direction. The Zohar says, on the second day of creation, okay, we don't have too many details in the Pesukim about what happened behind the scenes during creation. On the second day of creation, what was a monumental, contribution of Hashem to creation on the second day? He separated the upper waters from the lower waters. Upper waters from the lower waters. Now, it's a little bit esoteric, because, I mean, we can see the ocean, most of the world is water. Can't really see the upper waters. Sometimes it rains, but probably these upper waters are even higher than that. Okay, we know when the flood of Noah came. It says that the floodgates in both directions, up and down, opened up. It says in the Zohar that Hashem separated the Mayim Elyonim from the Mayim Tachtonim, the upper waters from the lower waters. And when that happened, the lower waters cried. Look at source number 10. He named an Ayom Asher Hakadosh Baruch Hu Hivdil Bein Mayim LaMayim. On that day, the second day, when Hashem separated from the upper waters to the lower waters, Hamayim Tachtonim Bochen, the lower waters cry, Anan Be'inan Lemehevei Kadam Malka Kadisha. We want to be in front. We want to be closer to Hashem. We were stripped away from our position in Shamayim, close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now there is an appeasement, like we saw yesterday in the Drasha. So Hashem took care of the moon. Took care of the lower waters as well. Any idea how Hashem appeased the lower waters for the separation from Shemayim?
Yes,
Nisach HaMayim, right? One example, there's mitzvahs we do with water. So one example is the Simchas Beis HaShoeva was bringing that water back from the depths and pouring it on the Mizbeach. Mikvah, Netil Shadayim, anything you name with water for sure. Most prominently in the Beis HaMikdash, in addition to Nisach HaMayim, was salt. Salt always goes on the Mizbeach. No meat, no korban, right? Anytime you shecht, right? You salt the meat. What's that?
Even the wood got
salted, right? The salt made its way on the Mizbeach, and the salt ultimately is derived from the Mayim Tachton. So, this is beautiful. It means the paradigm of tears, of crying, what it truly represents is feeling that distance from Hashem. The Jewish people had to go through the punishment of the Meraglim because they distorted. They took the power of tears. What did Adam HaRishon do when he thought that he was being thrown into the doghouse? What did the Gemara say? Zolgu Einav Demos. He cried because he thought Hashem was sending me away. And he was happy again when Hashem said, no, you're going to work for a living, but that ultimately is going to keep you connected. The Jewish people used their tears for the opposite purpose, for a mistaken understanding of thinking they were being banished, but in reality Hashem was bringing them closer. And the reason why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed on that day, right? What did the Medrash say that we started with? You cried for no reason. What does it mean for no reason? Because you interpreted what I did as a reason to cry, to feel distant from me. In reality, what I'm doing by bringing you into the Beis HaMikdash, by bringing you in Eretz Yisrael, is you should feel closer. You cried for no reason. So I'm going to give you a time to cry in all generations to learn how to use the tears the right way. What are tears for? You go to the airport sometimes, you know, and you know as you're pulling up and people are unloading their car, someone's about to enter the terminal. They're hugging and they're kissing and they're crying. They're sending their kid off to yeshiva or seminary for the year, and they're crying because when you feel distant, right? So your natural reaction is to cry. What we're suggesting, though, and stay tuned, hold on for a few more minutes. The cries are actually, in their pristine sense, a statement of closeness, right? We want to be closer. That's what happens at the airport also. We don't want to be separate. We don't want to be separate. But if you use the tears for the wrong reason, Hashem says, I need to teach you how to use the tears. The Beis HaMikdash was a place where we were as close as we could be to Hashem. You did something wrong, Hashem says, I'll bring you back. Bring a karban, easy, to atone, to make up, to reconnect. Over time, you know what the Beis HaMikdash was? It was a way to actually diminish your sensitivity to your connection with Hashem. No problem, I'll bring a karban and fix it. Right? There's two ways of looking at it, right? Either the karban is an opportunity or it's a shortcut. If it's an opportunity, it means we stay connected. If you use the Beis HaMikdash as a shortcut, then ultimately you're using the tool, the instrument of closeness, like the tears, and you're using it actually as an instrument for distance. So the tears of every year on Tisha B'Av are to retrain ourselves that the Beis HaMikdash that we're missing is not actually something that distances, it brings us closer. It heightens our sensitivity to our closeness to Hashem. There's a story of a soldier, a Chiloni soldier who was fighting in 1967. It was part of the paratrooper unit that freed the old city at the end of the Six-Day War. And understandably, the religious soldiers, and there were many religious soldiers as part of that unit, they got to the wall, they got to the Kotel, and they were crying and crying. And there was one secular soldier who was also crying. And the religious soldiers went over to him, not in a negative, condescending way, but they said, what are you crying about? And he said, I'm crying because I don't know what I'm supposed to be crying for. I don't know what it is that I'm supposed to be crying for. He knew that there was something there, but he felt a distance. He felt that he couldn't appreciate. He knew there was something to appreciate. There was a closeness at hand, but he felt that he could not connect to it. And that's where his tears came from. And that, in essence, I don't think it's all that different than our experience of Tisha B'Av either. Take a look at source number 11. I couldn't get the primary source, but Rabbi Zev Lef explains, Rabbi Zev Lef from Moshav from Moshav Matisyahu in Israel. He writes as follows. We're incapable of realizing what the Jewish people truly lost when the temple was destroyed. He compares us to people who have lived their entire lives in a ward where everyone is physically handicapped and to move around in wheelchairs. If such people were to suddenly see someone walking on two legs for the first time, they would either consider that person weird or the product of a miracle, because for them a handicapped world is the norm. Similarly, in a spiritual sense, we have become accustomed to the handicapped, deprived post-temple world, so that we cannot fathom or feel the true mournful effect of the lack of a temple. We have also become desensitized to the spiritual calamity that engulfs us as a result of the temple's destruction, so we cannot even understand what we are mourning. The tears that we are supposed to shed on Tisha B'Av are tears of distance. Because once upon a time, we felt that Hashem was distancing us from that closeness, and it was a mistake. So Hashem says, you're going to cry when you realize that I'm giving you that distance. I'm actually putting you in that scenario that you mistakenly thought was my intention. Ours is one step more removed, where it's impossible for us to even fathom what it is that we're missing. And we cry that we can't even approach, we can't even imagine what it was that we lost. We can't even imagine what it was that we lost. But we have a guidepost, we have a direction that the entirety of this period of time moving towards Tisha B'Av, the tears are supposed to represent an understanding that we want to be closer. They're tears over the distance, but they should never be disconnected from a desire. That soldier, his tears represented, he wanted to understand. He wanted to have a better appreciation of what he was looking at. And he felt, it moved him deep inside, that he could not connect with it. And that, like I said, is where we are. That's what all of this points us to. Let's make one final point that I think can give us a positive spin. On the final page, number 4, Rabbi Yitzhak Kotner, Rabbi Krauss's Rebbe, explains as follows, source number 12. Stam b'chia hi inyan shel tzar. Normally, if a person's crying, it means they're in pain. Stam schok hu inyan shel simcha. If you see someone laughing or smiling, it means they're happy. Ulu'uma zos. On the other hand, kishem is amenes lanu b'chia shel simcha. Every once in a while, there's a crossover and someone cries out of happiness. Hare b'chia hazu me'ida hi al simcha amuka har b'yoser me'asher simcha mufia b'panim shel schok. If someone cries out of joy, that implies that the joy or the cry is coming from a very, very deep place, because they're not responding the way you normally expect them to respond. Simana hamuvhak shel simcha mufia b'panim shel b'chia, the character trait, the characteristic of the simcha that is apparent on a person's face when they, with tears, that simcha, klapei stam simcha mufia b'panim shel schok, as opposed to the normal mode of happiness which is expressed with a smile, who, sheba tamid la'achar mituko shel tzar shekidim. When a person cries out of joy, how do the two fit together? It means that happiness has replaced a deep reservoir of challenge. Right? If parents are crying at their children's wedding, so they're not sad, okay? They're not sad that their kids are getting married, but where the emotion is coming from is 20, 25 years of hard work and hoping and yearning and praying that your kids come out okay and that they're going to be healthy and they're going to be self-sufficient and be able to start a new family, right? All that worry and concern that gets pent up for so many years of a parent raising a child, now it's that vacuum is filled with happiness, and it evokes the same tears that have built up when we were working to get to that point. And that's where the two types of emotions cross over. When good news, person hears good news, it fattens a person's bones, so to speak. It makes the person's face brilliant. The eyes are still where they were before. It's one thing to hear good news, you'll smile. But it penetrates deeper when that good news, you know,
You can hear good news that your favorite team won the Super Bowl, okay? But you didn't work all season to get to the big game. So the happiness is great. They won. When you're celebrating something that makes you cry out of happiness, it's, as Rupertner describes, it's replacing that reservoir of pain and challenge and hard work that got you to that point. I think this is very meaningful for us because we're familiar with the pasuk. It appears at the top of that page, Hazorim Bedima Berina Yiktzoru. We say it before benching. It's part of Shir Malas. Hazorim Bedima, those who sow, those who plant with tears will ultimately reap with happiness. If we go into this time of year, we're going to give a new spin on that notion. If someone plants with tears now, ultimately, Berina Yiktzoru, they'll be able to harvest those very same tears. It's not that I'm harvesting in happiness. Those same tears that I planted will be an expression of joy, ultimately. The cries of pain this time of year are a recognition of that distance that we feel from Hashem. But even Hashem ultimately wants that to later turn into, be transformed into an expression where the tears will be happiness the way they were supposed to be originally. Tears that represented, Hashem, I want to be closer to you, and I want to move in that direction of closeness, which was what the whole process of Eretz Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael was supposed to represent. And just to close, if you go back to page number 3 for a moment, with this we will conclude. The bottom section there is taken from a sefer by Rabbi Shimshon David Pinkus. Rabbi Pinkus was an American-born Talmud Chacham, moved to Israel. He died tragically in a car accident. He and his wife and a daughter, I think in 2000, 2001, very, very sad. And he was a prolific writer, speaker, and so much of his lectures have been published. And here's one from this time of year. Yeshna Imra Chasidit b'shem Rabbi Moshe Mikuver. Chasidish Avot. Shashloshes Hashavuos ben Yudzayim b'tamuz l'tishabav. Mechuvanim keneged shloshes Hashavuos shal hayom noraim hamaschim b'Rosh Hashanah. Very interesting. The 3 weeks that we mark from Shavuos B'Tammuz till Tisha B'Av parallels precisely the 3 weeks that begin on Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei. It's actually 22 days. When we say 3 weeks, it's 3 weeks plus Tisha B'Av, it's 22 days. That's the exact number of days from Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei, concluding with Shmini Atzeres, which, at least in Israel, is the 22nd day of Tishrei. Not a coincidence. Why? I think Michelangelo or Leonardo, they were famous for painting like this. They'd start with a canvas and it would be all black. First they would color it all black. And as they would go from the background to the foreground, they would add lighter and lighter colors until it all came together in a beautiful painting when it was all finished. So that's the same thing that's going on over here. We go through a summer period of 3 weeks, which is like treating the canvas with the darkness. Going through this time, the 3 weeks, the 9 days, Tisha B'Av, where we really root into ourselves the feeling of gullus, of distance, the tears that are evoked. Why? To set the stage for the 3 weeks that will be upon us in about 6 to 8 weeks from now. Only after painting that black, that dark background, then the painter begins to paint. The 3 weeks of mourning now, it's the background for the 3 weeks that we'll celebrate in Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. And I think this brings out everything we've said. If a person can cry Hazorim Bedima this time of year, feeling that distance and where we're supposed to be moving towards, then the 3 weeks of distance in the summer will be expressed in their full joy when Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot come, and our goal is to bring back Klal Yisrael to the closeness to Hashem through the very holy, elevated, happy, positive 3 weeks that we will find ourselves in not too long from now, Mirat Hashem, September and October. Something to think about as we enter Tisha B'Av, to feel distant is a good thing because it creates the background of appreciating that what we're moving towards is actually a sense of closeness, which is what Hashem always intended for us from the beginning of our history.
Have a wonderful evening, and we should be zocha to have a meaningful week ahead. Thank you for joining us at home. Have a wonderful night.
Another kind of tears. My mother's tears. My mother's tears.